Okay, thanks a lot. I'd like to start by thanking the organizers. Who are the organizers? for the invitation to come to KITP. It's always great to be here and to give this talk, of course. So I'll talk about tensor network renormalization and holography, and that's an overview talk. I was asked to discuss the subject in broad terms. I will also include some results, and most of those are in collaboration with Glenn Evenly at UC Irvine, who is a postdoc with the chair, Steve. So let's see, I've broken this talk into three pieces. The first part is going to be old stuff. I want to introduce to those who are not familiar with it the multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, or MIRA, which is what happens when you try to combine tensor networks and the renormalization group. And in particular, we'll see that this tensor network, which is meant to describe, is a variational ansatz for many-body ground states. We'll see that it can be interpreted both as a quantum circuit and as a renormalization group transformation. Then, in the second part, I want to talk about MIRA in relation to holography, and there are two signs here. The first one says, wow, and the second one means I don't know what holography is, so we'll see what I can say. But luckily, there will be a number of talks today and tomorrow to compensate for my introduction. And in the third part, I want to tell you about some recent results in relation back to the MIRA, which are the following. We've learned how this variational ansatz comes naturally as a result of the following, given a Hamiltonian, a many-body Hamiltonian, for which we want to build a MIRA for the ground state. We can get this ground state as a result of coarse-graining the Euclidean path integral for this Hamiltonian, and that has some advantages, and in particular, we'll see that this leads to a natural way of having a MIRA for thermal states, whose holographic dual is a black hole. And I will rush over this last bit, but luckily Glenn Evenly was here in May 7th. He gave a talk, so if you're interested in details on this part, you can go, and it's online. Very good. And yes, questions are welcome, etc. Very well. So what are we trying to do? What's the main goal of these tensor networks? Remember, what we're trying to do is to represent the wave function of the ground state, the full wave function of the ground state of some many-body Hamiltonian. We typically work on a lattice, so that's going to be, you can think of this as the Hamiltonian for a set of n quantum spins on a lattice. And we all know that expressing this wave function in terms of a local basis takes exponentially many complex coefficients. We can do that, but we cannot do that efficiently. And so tensor networks are an attempt to turn that calculation into an efficient one. So this will be my one-line introduction to tensor networks. So let me try to read this. This is an equation. We have left-hand side, right-hand side. So in the left-hand side, what I'm doing is I'm using a circle with legs to represent a tensor. Okay, this will be here all the time for the next hour or so, that every time you see a circle, you have to think that that's a tensor, and every time with a number of indices that correspond to the number of legs in this tensor. So for instance, here you have to imagine that there are n legs, one per each spin that we have, or each quantum spin. And so this tensor here, this circle with n legs, represents this exponentially many amplitudes. Okay, we organize these exponentially many amplitudes with n indices, and so that's what we represent on the left-hand side here. And on the right-hand side, what we have is what we're going to call a tensor network, which is nothing but a collection of small tensors connected together into some network pattern. In this case, we have a one-dimensional array. And then this is an equality. So in particular, we have that there are n open indices here and n open indices there. So there we are. That's a tensor network. If you think for a couple of minutes, then let me tell you why we want to use this type of thing. So as I said, if we try to consider a large number of spins, if we try to consider the ground state of many particles or many sides on our lattice, then we have to find this exponential growth of coefficients just to represent the wave function. Now what we're trying to do is we're trying to represent the wave function using less coefficients, and that's what the tensor network is going to do for us in the following sense. imagine that we have each tensor here, it has only three indices. Imagine that this index, these Born indices, run only over a finite number of values, say chi. So then each tensor by itself it contains a number of coefficients, which is chi squared times some times 2, because there is this extra. So what we have is a finite number of coefficients on each tensor. And now the number of tensors only grows linearly in the system size, right? So this will be for n spins. If we want to consider n plus 1 spin, we just add another tensor, okay? So we have, on the left-hand side, we have exponentially many parameters. On the right-hand side, we have a number of parameters, which in this case is only linear in the system size. So that's good. That's good. That's good in the sense that we can efficiently, now we can grow the system size without much issues. But of course, we need to understand what we're doing here. We cannot represent an arbitrary wave function just by using order n parameters. So we are actually restricting our attention to a subset of states of the many-body system. So that's what this picture tries to represent. We have a Hilbert space, which is huge, has the Hilbert space of n spins, has a dimension which is exponentially large in n, and a generic state will correspond to some point in this region. Now, tensor network states are just a variational class. They only target some submanifold within this huge Hilbert space. And so we will not be able to cover the full Hilbert space, only a small region. But the hope is the following. The hope is that there will be this will be good enough to approximate ground states of local Hamiltonians. And why? So this picture here represents the Hilbert space, again, the huge Hilbert space. And what we've learned in recent years by studying entanglement and seeing that entanglement entropy scales as an area law or at most logarithmic corrections around it, we've learned that ground states of local Hamiltonians are also very small, very special states, which are just a small submanifold in the huge Hilbert space. And our hope then, by using tensor networks, is that we will have non-trivial overlap between the states that we can efficiently represent and the ground states, which are the ones that we want to represent. Okay? So that was tensor networks, and now you know everything. And so what I want to do next is I want to talk about the particular tensor network, and this will be this multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz. And so, you know, you draw the tensors, you put them together like this, and now I want to describe why we put them together like this, what it is that this can do for you. So the first thing I'm going to say is that this is a variational class of states for one-dimensional systems. So you can imagine, if you look at the, imagine that there are, or this index connects with this one. So what we have on the right and left-hand side are periodic boundary conditions, okay? And the only open indices are the ones down here, okay? So remember, this is a tensor network. If you crunch together, if you contract all these indices, you end up with a wave function. Okay, a wave function of a system of spins that live down here, each index, each open index corresponds to a spin. Okay, so this is a variational ansatz for the ground state of a spin chain. All right, so as such, it's interesting because we are trying to represent a wave function of a one-dimensional system living down here, and yet we use a tensor network that extends in this space direction, but also in an additional direction, which we will call scale. It has to do with scale in the system, length scale in the system. So the first observation then is that the meta is a variational class of states represented by a tensor network that extends in an additional direction, which is scale. Very good. And why is that interesting? Well, the first the comment about that is that in this way, if we have the additional direction, then we can store variational parameters that will describe the properties of the ground state. We can store them in different locations such that if we want to consider properties of the many-body wave function that correspond to some length scale, say a short length scale, we'll store them in this tensor down here. Instead, if we want to use properties, or if we want to talk about properties that refer to longer length scale, we'll store them up higher up. For instance, in particular, by changing variational parameters up here, we change properties of the wave function for the whole system, okay? So completely delocalized. We have the ability to store in different places of the tensor network information about different length scales in the wave function. All right?
So the storage of the variation parameters is what you mean by variation classes? That's how you generate variation?
No. So if you look at this, you see this represents a bunch of tensors. If you multiply them together, you are left with just a huge tensor with a large number of indices down here. And that is your, that contains the exponentially many coefficients, complex coefficients, for the wave function. Remember, the wave function is a collection of complex coefficients for all possible amplitudes of the local basis in spins. And this represents, this is a sparse way of representing this huge tensor.
And two levels of variation, the spins and then information.
The spins do not, yeah. What we have is this huge set of exponentially many amplitudes that define the wave function. And we decide to represent them in terms of this collection of small tensors connected together. Okay, so each tensor contains variational parameters, and what I'm saying is that these tensors are distributed in space and scale in such a way that the variational parameters living up here will affect the wave function, will determine properties of the wave function at a very large length scale, whereas the tensors, variational parameters that I store down here, will determine properties of the wave function only in a neighborhood, a small neighborhood. Very good, thanks for the question. So what I want to tell you then is that I want us to build some intuition of what this type of variational class of states can do or can represent. And in order to do that, it's useful to think of this as secretly being both a quantum circuit and a renormalization group transformation. So I want to spend a couple of minutes explaining why this MERA is secretly both a quantum circuit and also a renormalization group transformation. So let's go first for the quantum circuit. So what we're going let me put names to these tensors. So you can see, if you look carefully, you'll see that there are two types of tensors in this tensor network. There are tensors that have four legs, say this one here, one, two, three, four legs, four indices. And so I'm going to call these guys disentanglers. Okay, maybe the reason will become apparent later on. But so four indices, tensors with four legs are disentanglers. You can understand them as being a gate or a unitary transformation on two spins. Okay, you take two spins and you apply a unitary transformation to those two together, and that's represented by this disentangler. It's a two-body unitary gate. And then we also have these other tensors, the isometries, which have only three indices. So take this one here, has three indices, one, two, and three. And then this isometry, again, we are going to think, or we could think of them, of an isometry as being, again, a two-body unitary gate as the disentangler, but with in a situation where one of the it's a unitary evolution on two spins where one spin has a fixed state zero. Okay, so that's why we only need to represent the other leg, incoming leg. Okay, so if we have this picture, then it takes so what I've done here is I've replaced every isometry with this two-body gate, and now it looks like that. And now I'm going to take each of these extra legs with a zero, and I'm going to stretch it, and I'm going to put it to the top. And the first observation is that it took me like half an hour to draw this. And you just see it for a second. It's really not fair. But there is a picture that you can take out, take home from here, which is that indeed this very much looks like a quantum circuit where we start with a state up here, which is a product state. All the spins are in a product state. And our variational state for the ground state, also our variational class of states, is the result of starting from this product state, no entanglement at all, apply this quantum circuit here. This quantum circuit, remember, it's just made of take two spins and entangle them, apply a unitary transformation to them, and move on. Right? So there is some time that has nothing to do with physical time in any actual physical system. It's just the quantum computer time. This actually would be a way of preparing this state in a quantum computer, but please let's not get confused. I want to talk about real things. What this is just a way of thinking of this. So the state, the variational class that we're considering, is the result of taking a product state with no entanglement whatsoever and entangling pairwise the qubits or the spins according to this pattern of interactions. Okay? So the net result will be an entangled state, and again, let me say that this gate here, the first one, the top one, will entangle these two spins which are in a product state, after which these spins will go around, will get entangled with more and more and more and more. And so what we see is that we start with no entanglement at all, and what we're doing is we're introducing entanglement at different length scales. As we go down in time, we are introducing entanglement at shorter and shorter length scales, and for instance, this guy here is only introducing entanglement for these two qubits. Okay? So again, we're introducing entanglement into the wave function in a progressive way, starting from large length scales and going all the way down to short length scales. Very good. Yes?
Was there any significance to the topmost guy, the red one, being entangled by the neighboring ones, but the next, the yellow ones, being entangled from the middle of the chain?
No. The initial positions here you see cannot be very important because, well, the important positions are the ones down here. This is this describes the one-dimensional system that you are interested in. So these two spins are nearest neighbors in the spin chain. That these two indices correspond to nearest neighbor spins in the spin chain. And the rest is whatever you have to do to sequentially introduce entanglement at different length scales. So, yes. There is no, don't read too much into the fact that they are going. That's right. It's not too important.
Yes. Can you say number of these initial zeros is the same as the number of visible
spins? That's right, yes. Yes. So there are n spins here, and there are n unentangled spins there, and the point, the quantum circuit is a unitary transformation, so it doesn't change the Hilbert space, the dimension of the Hilbert space. It maps a product state into an entangled state within in the set. It's still a state of n spins. Thanks.
And the two-body unitary was just a matter of convenience. You could have done many-body unitary.
So we could do three-body, four-body, but there is this in the end is a computational scheme, and the cost of this computational scheme will grow exponentially in how in the L body, in the L of L body when you attack L sides at a time. So you want to keep it as small as possible. Okay, thanks. So then I want to insist something that even sometimes people who work on this find confusing. So the mirror is both, it's the sum of two things. It's this tensor network that I just described, and also are some restriction on the tensors in the tensor network. So let me say that carefully. So the tensor network is whatever I just drew here before, the way we connect the tensors together. But then these tensors, which are full of variational parameters, which we will optimize to find the best possible approximation to the ground state of a given Hamiltonian, these tensors are full of variational parameters, but they are subject to constraints. These tensors, as I just said, this was a quantum circuit, so these tensors are unitary gates, okay? So in particular, these entanglers, it's a unitary gate U on two spins. Of course, times U dagger has to give back the identity on the two spins. Okay, so this is a non-trivial constraint on the variational parameters that we have. There is this constraint, and there is another constraint for the isometries, which is analogous to that. So what we're saying is these tensors are isometric or unitary. Okay, so we have that the mirror is defined by these two properties, not just tensor network, the way we connect the tensors, but also the constraints on those tensors. And why is that relevant? Well, it turns out that this gives a causal structure to this tensor network. And that will be relevant in the context of holography. But originally, this was not developed, or this was developed by somebody who was completely unaware of what holography was. This was not... The causal structure is prior to any possible holographic interpretation, but it will be relevant for that in that context. So this causal structure has to do, it's essential for a number of properties of these ansatz, and in particular also to be able to computationally, efficiently compute with it, but these are details I'm not going to go into. So this gives you locality. For instance, if you want to study how to cosign a local operator, if you don't have unitarity, this will come in a minute, actually. Right, so there is only a boundary. The rest is drawings. So we have a quantum system, and we'll see that this is a cosine transformation. We'll see it in a minute. And this cosine transformation preserves locality of local operators. So you take a local operator and you cosine it, but by this cosine transformation that we'll see. And this cosine transformation will produce a local operator, a cosine local operator, only if we have these constraints. Okay. So as a cosine transformation, you would like that even though you're changing length and scale in your system, what's a local object remains local in the cosine description, and that demands that we use these constraints. But we'll see that in a minute.
And the causal structure was in the sort of fiducial time of the building up of the circuit, not in physical time.
Right, there is no physical time so far, and we will not study time evolution here today. Yes. So it's all in this, right, the causal structure has to do with this quantum computation. It's telling you that there is a time in the quantum computation. That's right. Very good. So, but we will see then in Bartek Cech's talk later today, right after the break, that there is a way of interpreting all this in holographic terms. This will imply that this looks like the Sitter space in a way that I would love to tell you if I knew what it means.
Is there any variational freedom of connecting differently
there is some freedom. There is always a cost, computational cost, that you pay if you rewire things, and so that. But it's it's not. That's right. I'm not going to be playing around with the wiring. I'm going to fix the wiring. And yes. Okay. So in particular, this causal structure tells us the following. So again, this represents the wave function for the spin chain that lives down here. And well, we can ask the question, how, in given a region A of our spin chain, we can ask the question, this wave function, how does it look on this region? So we can ask, what's the reduced density matrix for that region, right? Given the many-body wave function, how the many-body wave function looks restricted to this region. And it turns out that these constraints define a causal cone. So this past causal cone, so this is region A, and the shaded region here is the past causal cone of region A. And what we're saying is that the meaning of this region is that if I want to compute the reduced density matrix down here, it will depend on the parameters stored in the tensors that are inside the causal cone. So in particular, this tensor here, I can change this tensor here, variational parameters, I can change those, and they will not affect the reduced density matrix there. Okay? So this causal cone means that for the purposes of computing the reduced density matrix, I only need to look at this part of the tensor network. Very good. So this will have some relevance in the next talk, not in mine. So I said that the meta was secretly a quantum circuit, and it had this causal structure. And I also said that meta is secretly a renormalization group transformation. And let me explain what I mean by that. So here is a possible way of cosigning a lattice system. We have a lattice made of number of sites, n sites. And we want to cosigning it into a lattice. Its dot represents a site. We want to cosigning it into a lattice made of half as many sites. Okay, we go from n sites to n half sites. And a way of doing that, following ideas from Kalanov, is by taking two sides into one, by blocking two sides and analyzing within these two sides, identifying some sat space and keeping those degrees of freedom. And this was proposed a long time ago, this type of schemes, but it was significantly improved by Steve White, who probably doesn't recognize his work in this drawing. But no, what I want to take from the work of Steve in the MRG is that he understood, he told us how to actually variationally optimize these tensors. Okay? That there was a recipe that if you wanted this to be a good cosgraining, and there was a way of optimizing prior to Steve's DMRG, the thought was that you just take the reduced Hamiltonian on these two sides, and then you diagonalize the Hamiltonian on the restricted block, and that defines an effective space. But with Steve, what we learn is that we have to look at the bigger picture and choose locally how to constrain these two sides by understanding the wave function on the whole system. That's what we took from the MRG. Okay? And so this is a constraining transformation that tells you every two sides, just replace blocks of two sides with a single side and use some isometric tensor and isometry to define states, the Hilbert space here as a set space of the Hilbert space of these two sides. Okay? That's what this tensor network means. It's just defining a set space of these two sides. Okay, and then the proposal was to add something to this scheme for a reason that I'll explain in a minute, where we still want to take these two sides into a single side, but instead of just cosgraining directly, we're going to add. So instead of just using the isometry to cosgrain, before we use the isometry to take two sides into one, we're going to use these entanglers or these unitary gates, which will allow these two spins, which are going to end up being together and becoming a single spin, they will be allowed to unitarily evolve with nearest neighbors. And that's a small detail, but it turns out to be an important one in the following sense. So imagine that we want to cosgrain a wave function, or imagine that we're trying to constrain a system where the ground state has short-range entanglement, meaning that these two qubits have some degree of entanglement, these two spins are entangled. Then, in both cases, what we can do is this short-range entanglement, we're going to take these two spins and they're going to become together, so this entanglement is gone from the picture, because entanglement is something that correlates to two distinct sides. If these two distinct sides will be identified, then the entanglement is gone. Right, so this is a good thing, because short-range entanglement is these are microscopic details that you don't want in your coarse grain picture. So short-range entanglement should disappear from, should not be present in the coarse grain lattice. And same thing happens down here. We'll use this isometry to bring together these two sides, so this entanglement is going to be gone from the effective description. The problem comes when we consider entanglement that connects two spins which will not become part of the same effective spin. Okay? So what I'm saying is that if you apply a cosgraining transformation of this form, when you cosgrain it, then this spin will become part of this spin will become part of this spin, and this short-range entanglement will be promoted to longer-range entanglement. It was short-range entanglement down here between neighbor spins, now it becomes entanglement between neighboring spins at the larger length scale. Okay, so we didn't remove that short-range entanglement, we kept it in the effective description, and that doesn't sound right. These are microscopic details that survive our RG scheme. Whereas down here, now what we see is that because of the disentanglers, these disentanglers can be used to remove this short-range entanglement, and so it will not survive. Okay, so that's the basic idea why we're using these disentanglers in the mirror. So what I'm saying is that you want to think now of this meta as being made of different layers, where each layer is identified with a coarse-grain transformation. So at each layer of the meta, you have some lattice. This lattice is made of a number of sides, n in this case, n over 2 in L prime, n over 4, and so on. And so when I gave you a wave function in terms of the meta, I didn't give you a wave function. I gave you actually a wave function for each level. Okay. So let me say that again. If I give you this tensor network, this defines a wave function for the original lattice, but it also defines, if I remove this layer of tensors, I already obtain a tensor network description for some wave function in this other lattice, and so on. Okay. So you have a sequence of wave functions.
For are there disentanglers? Disentanglers are these four index options?
Yes. So you can recognize here disentanglers, which are unitary acting on two legs, and then the isometries, which are taking two legs into one. That's its layer here is a cosine transformation of the type I just defined. Okay? So, good. So we have a cosine transformation built in this tensor network, and so that's what I just said. And now that implies that Meta defines an RG flow in the space of wave functions. Okay, it's not just one wave function, but you keep removing layers and you get other wave functions for coherent systems. You can imagine that this is an infinite system, and so when you coherent an infinite system, surprise, you get another infinite system, and then you can study a flow in the space of wave functions.
Is there a sense in which this transformation also means, say, I don't know, coarse grading at the level of free energy or Hamiltonian?
Good question, because I have an answer. So let me, another half an hour went into this drawing. So what this represents is the space of wave functions, and then as you cross grain, you move in this space, and you can study the old school RG flow. Instead of the space of constants or coupling constants, you do it in the space of wave functions. And you can identify fixed points and, critical fixed points, trivial fixed or gap fixed points, and so on. And now the question. So many people are disappointed by this picture because they were told that we should work with Hamiltonians. So the good news is that the Meta also defines an RG flow in the space of Hamiltonians. And that has to do with all this explanation before on causality and causal structure. So what I want to do is for us to think for a second. Suppose that this is a local operator acting on the initial lattice. So we have this lattice, and we have a local operator in it. So a local operator looks like the identity on most of spins, right? These vertical bars. It's doing nothing on those spins, and then in three spins, it's doing some non-trivial transformation. That's what a local operator on three spins would do, and then more spins, these identities are trivial action on the rest of the spins. And so what I can do now is I can take this cosine transformation, which of course is defined at the level of the Hilbert space. It takes states into states, but of course we can apply it by conjugation to operators. Okay. So what this is our local operator after applying the cosine transformation defined by one layer of the Meta. Hi.
Say I do second order perturbation theory at each step of the coarse graining of the Hamiltonian,
yes.
And for the wave function, I do a different transformation, which is first order. Mm-hmm. So it looks like it's not the same network for the Hamiltonian and for the wave function.
Who wants to apply perturbative approach when it is fully non-perturbative?
No, it's just to...
To make the connection.
I fully agree. It's just to show that it's not necessarily the same network that acts to generate your Hamiltonian in your state.
Oh, okay, I see. So, fair enough. What I'm interested here is in a scheme where you tell me how the Hilbert space transforms, and you don't have to come up with another story about how operators transform, right? So, this is a fully consistent cosine transformation where I explain to you how I transform the Hilbert space. And of course, if you tell me how the Hilbert space transforms, it should follow how linear operators on that Hilbert space transform, right? So this is a fully consistent picture. Now, perturbative analysis may allow you for some divergence between how you transform the wave function and how you transform the Hilbert space. But if that approach is correct, it is because it's somehow consistent, self-consistent. In any case, there is nothing wrong with having a consistent scheme. But it's consistent, but this looks pretty bad because you started with a local operator acting on only three spins, and now you see you have a mesh acting on many spins of the cosine lattice. But that's where we just need to remember that.
Sorry, you may be related, but
tensors.
So it seems like you have to choose the tensors based on the state. I mean, the way you showed that you can use these disentanglers so that you remove, you know, short-range entanglement. But, you know, there's no one unitary which will convert every state to a product state.
That's right. Right? So, that's right. So I just wanted to point out that putting these entanglers offers, at least potentially, the possibility of removing short-range entanglement. Potentially.
But if I want to think about this as a flow in the space of wave functions or Hamiltonians, I have to have a rule somehow for deciding what tensor I put for each state, right?
That is true. So there will be some variational optimization that will take care of that. Okay, but I was trying to not go into the details. I was trying to talk about properties that are just part of the variational class before we even optimize the tensors.
I mean, for some Hamiltonian, you might not want to remove the
entanglement. Right. That's
the variation.
So we'll see that this can be applied variationally, and we'll have some properties. But I was again trying to discuss properties which don't require to go to that level. That level is the one where you have a concrete Hamiltonian, and then you want that coarse-graining transformation or that variational wave function to have something to do with that Hamiltonian. So far, I'm just talking about properties. Here I said, this is a local operator. I didn't tell you what operator it is. I just focus on the fact that it's local. And what I want to say is that by any choice of variational parameters, what we'll have is that this entangler here, this is U dagger. Remember, there was a constraint on those, so they will annihilate. And the same will happen once we annihilate all these tensors, we'll end up with a construction like this. Yes?
Is it obvious that, so in the end, you're going to use a variational principle to get the ground state energy, minimize the energy, right?
Yes.
That's going to define the actual mirror in the end.
It's going to determine the variational parameters, right?
The free parameters.
Yes.
Keeping a given structure with you.
Right.
Is it obvious that in choosing those variational parameters and then that which defines them as flow for all local operators, you get the same result that the flow in the Hamiltonian will give you an operator whose ground state is the same as your
It's not obvious.
It's true, though?
It is true. This is approximately true, but to high accuracy.
What is approximately?
So I just wanted to say we should try to save some of the Giffre has a lot to get through in a short time, so we should hold some of the questions till.
Yeah, we can discuss this later.
And
that's
after
fine.
The talk.
So. Okay, good. Remember, no questions. So local operators are mapped into local operators. Okay, that's the conclusion. This coarse-grained transformation is such that when you apply it to local operator, there are all these constellations of U dagger, W W dagger, and so on. And so you end up with some new tensor that acts on three spins only of the new of the coarse-grained lattice and has the identity everywhere else. So good, because now you give me your local Hamiltonian, and term by term is coarse-graining to a sum of local Hamiltonian local terms. So we have a flow in the space of Hamiltonians. Is that the question?
Yeah.
No questions. Okay, it's an important question, yes.
Because there are these zeros that you're feeding in. So
yes.
The network is an embedding from the coarse-grained Hilbert space into the less coarse, into the fine-grained Hilbert space, but it's not one-to-one, right? It embeds into it. So if you take an arbitrary local operator in the UV Hilbert space and you conjugate it by the network, you'll get something that acts on the zeros, right? It won't be something that just because you're feeding in the zero.
Then I'm only referring to this drawing, plus the properties that I said before, which is that if you have this tensor and its conjugate, it disappears. They disappear. They become identity, and then this allows me to graphically go from here to here. So I'm not saying that the coarse-grained operator is a faithful that you kept the properties of that are relevant to low energies. I didn't say that. No, I just said you take an operator and it becomes a local operator becomes a local operator at the next length scale. That's all that this drawing is saying. Okay? Very good. Good. So let's keep going. You are doing really bad with time. So we have entanglement entropy and correlations, and here what I wanted to say was that because of properties of the structure of this tensor network, which I won't describe, the entropy of a region of size L scales as logarithmic, the logarithm of L, and that's nice because that's what you expect in a critical system. So that's again a property built in the variational ansatz, and correlations decay as a power law. And that has something to do with the fact that if you try to look at the distance between this point and that point L sides away, you within the tensor network you have to go log L, you have to jump log L tensors only. So the summary so far is that that we're running out of time. And so, yeah, no, so the sentence is here. So now, a lot of talking, but does it work? Does this ansatz work? And that's probably the spirit of several questions. So what I'm going to do now is you give me a Hamiltonian, a critical Hamiltonian on the lattice, say criticalizing model to be original. And then we're going to optimize all these variational parameters using some method that I won't describe, okay? And I just want to talk about what happens after the optimization, okay? So I've talked about generic properties of the tensor network, and now I want to talk about what happens after you optimize the variational parameters. And what we find is that this tensor network, given a particular Hamiltonian and after the optimization, gives rise to this property that we can take local operators and coarse-grain them. And in particular, we can ask what local operators are coarse-graining to themselves, right? And the answer, well, and then we get some answer, and the answer has to do with the scaling operators of the theory. And for instance, for the criticalizing model, we don't have a number of primary fields, identity, the spin, the energy density, also the disorder and fermions in the non-local sector. And this would be the scaling dimensions that you would expect, and these are the numerical results that we obtained. So you see that there is accuracy with a few digits, and then this allows you to recover the towers, the conformal towers of the CFT, directly by asking the question: what happens to local operators when I coarse-grain them? And this is nice, but then we can also get the operator product expansion coefficients of the CFT. So you take three of these local operators, you coarse-grain them together, and see whether they fuse to the identity. What's the amplitude, and then these are the exact results that you would expect when you fuse operators, and we obtain them numerically with a few digits of accuracy again. And so the idea is that from these ansatz, you can extract the conformal data of the CFT, central charge, scaling dimensions, conformal spin, operator product expansion. We exploit the scale invariance by putting all the layers to be the same, and then we can consider infinitely many layers. Good, and then I wanted to show some more recent results, but to minimize damage, I'm going to jump into what so this was about an ansatz that we use in the context of trying to extract information from a quantum system. We're trying to characterize the ground state. But then Brian Swingle pointed out in 2009 that actually this mirror, with its additional dimension corresponding to scale and so on, looked like a realization of holography. Okay, so I had to go to Wikipedia, and it was too early. There was no entry for holography. Had to go to the papers, didn't understand them. But what Brian taught us is that we should be thinking really about a potentially very interesting relationship between this tensor network and the holographic principle. And I think I have one more minute. So what I'm going to so there were some serious reasons.
Why don't you try to finish up by 5 till? We'll just have 5 minutes for the rest of the questions.
Okay, that would be great. So another 30 minutes, that's good. okay, so there was some evidence there. And so Brian came up also with wrote another paper in 2012, constructing holographic spacetime using entanglement renormalization, where he started telling us or analyzing what would large N limit mean in the context of Mera, and how that would imply the emergence of a classic spacetime, and also a sparsity of the spectrum of scaling dimensions, and a number of properties that you would expect in holography. If Mera is to be taken seriously as describing some gravity theory in the bulk, then there are a number of of issues or aspects to be discussed. And then something happened. It's August 20th, 2013, and you know, I panicked because I don't follow Twitter. Wait, John, come. Good. Okay, so I don't follow Twitter, but somebody sent me an email. Have you seen, you know, John's tweet? And like, what is that? And but they gave me a link, and I clicked, and there was this thing. Now Juan Malcena is explaining tensor networks, and this is KITP, and it's like, woohoo. So I went, I rushed to, I quick work, I pick up my kids, went home, you know, went to the supermarket, got a lot of food. You never know what's happening next. But what happened is that a number of people started using tensor networks in the context of holography, and that's really, that was very, very exciting. And in particular, there was this paper, Time Evolution of Entanglement Entropy from Black Hole Interiors by Thomas Harman and Juan Malacena. And I started seeing these drawings, and it's like, hey, they got it wrong. You know, it's upside down. And, but very nice. So actually, this is a tensor network for a thermostat. I think I first saw this type of, this is a conjectured expression for the, or tensor network description of a thermostat that had already also been conjectured by Brian. And a number of papers followed from that. An interesting development, also closely related to holography, that is this paper by Jutta Hegemann and collaborators on entanglement renormalization for quantum fields. And so the idea here is what happens? We've been working on the lattice all the time. So what happens if we put this, if we deal with this directly in the continuum? How do we write a meta directly in the continuum? So remember, this is space, this is scale, and we have tensors at different points in space and scale. And so we have we think of the meta as a unitary transformation that breaks into small gates in space and scale. And so what these authors proposed was a continuous version of that, where instead of having gates in different discrete places of space and scale, they replace it with some kind of Hamiltonian density or some operator that lives continuously in space and scale. Okay, and there are many details there, and obviously I'm not going to cover them, but this construction has indeed been used by several people in the context of holography. You can see some of the usual suspects here. Shinsei Ryu and Tadashi Takayanagi wrote at least three papers on this. I think there is a fourth one. And other authors also joining. So this is the use of a continuous version of the meta in the context of holography. Another development is this branching meta, where what we study now is the possibility that our system, instead of constraining into one lattice, it constrains into two independent lattice systems. And this is related to Brian Swingle's talk yesterday. So this would be, if I understood properly, this would be this S sorcery with S equal to 2, where you branch into two systems. But there will be a talk today, and that's probably the reason for this slide, by Jiangang Ha. After Bartek's talk, so this morning, the last talk in the morning, will be many-body entanglement witness and branching meta, which is this construction, so we'll hear more about this later today. My favorite, or one of my favorites, is Xiao Liang's Qi exact holographic mapping, where the idea that you have this meta, which is a unitary transformation from the boundary, now it's taken seriously in the context of holography by as a map directly from the Hilbert space at the boundary to the Hilbert space and the bulk. That we'll hear Tadashi Takayanagi give a talk tomorrow on how to use ideas from tensor networks to define the surface state correspondence as a generalized holography, and so on. Oh, John Preskill will give a talk tomorrow as well on holographic quantum error correcting codes. There have been a number of papers, and the next talk will be by Bartek. So we will hear a number of talks, so maybe I don't need to talk about it myself. Maybe the conclusion, since I'm running out of time, is that, well, what's happening here? So the meta was a construction that in the end, it's RG. Let's apply the ideas of the renormalization group to a lattice system in real space. That's what the meta is. It's a realization of the ideas of the renormalization group in real space. And as such, you can apply it to non-interacting and no large n field theories, so far away from the typical range of application of holography, not the unique range, but the typical range of applicability. And so what we have is a tensor network for a ground state of a CFT, where the tensor network lives in an extra dimension corresponding to scale. And so we can have this dictionary, but this is not an ADS CFT dictionary. This is just a meta dictionary. Okay? So what we're saying is at the boundary, we have a state of a CFT, and in the bulk we have a tensor network. What this tensor network means, I'm not going to go there. We could try to interpret it in terms of a holographic space-time, but so a gravity theory, but I'm saying that what we have is a tensor network. You can read as much into it as you want, but it's just a collection of tensors. And so you can think of this as a state, so this tensor network representing the ground state of a CFT, or more generally, since this was a unitary circuit, in the spirit of the exact holographic mapping, you can understand this as a map, a unitary transformation that maps the Hilbert space at the boundary with a Hilbert space now living in the interior. So we have, at the level of purely meta, we have that the scaling dimensions, if you are using this to analyze a CFT, you have that the scaling dimensions of the CFT transform into masses or exponentially suppressed correlations in the scale direction. But this occurs just as a result of this being related to the RG transformation. We have this entanglement entropy that scales as a logarithmically in the size of the region at the boundary. And this has to do with how the tensor network is connected. So if you try to split this part of the wave function from the rest, you'll have a minimal number of cuts that you'll have to cut indices, how many log L. So that looks very closely related to Ryo Takayanagi formula, but it's just counting how many indices you have to cut. And then also other things that happen is if you have a global symmetry living at, so if you consider the IZ model, so you have this Z2 global symmetry, then that turns into a gauge or local symmetry for the tensors. That also happens. So these are properties that you expect in holography, but they just follow from this simple construction, which is just a RG construction. Okay, and so what we have is the main operator at scale that if we insist in talking about a relation to ADS, then the distance between tensors corresponds to ADS radius, okay, on the order of ADS radius. So there have been questions about whether there is any chance of describing sub ADS physics, sub ADS scale physics. And, well, the continuous meta scene would be possibly a way of resolving that. In the continuous meta, there is no discretization. And then also what happens when you consider that at the boundary you have a gauge theory with large N and strong interactions, that's also included in this framework, but you need to work out what the consequences are, right? So in that case, indeed, you expect to have the holographic dual or the distensor network will possibly look like a theory of gravity, but you really have to go and add to this simple picture by understanding the consequences of dealing with concrete CFTs. Very well. And so the part three is the part that you are not going to see, but it's not big deal because Glenn gave this talk on May 7th. So if you are interested in this, you just go and watch it there. And so the summary is this, that we have this meta distensor network that was proposes the variational ansatz for ground states of critical theories on the lattice, so CFTs on the lattice, and for instance, for the critical IZ model, as simple as that. And it works well for those systems. We can recover all the conformal lat of the underlying CFT. And then I mentioned the branching meta just because one of the talks today will be related to that, so it's a possible extension of this ansatz. And then I try to go through a number of works done in relation that relate meta to ADS CFT, and luckily we'll have three talks, two tomorrow, one today, expanding on that. So no big deal if I don't have time to explain it a bit better. And finally, the part that we haven't seen, which is the part that you can watch online. Thank you very much.
Questions?
So you showed these very interesting results. I mean, you're able to determine the scaling dimensions of the Ising conformal field theory. So what happens if you consider a more complicated field theory, like a compactified boson, the Heisenberg spin chain, for instance? Can you do the same? Can you play the same? Can you get the same result?
I have this one. So So this is compactified boson without compactification, meaning it's equal to one. It's in the family. We just chose that to start with.
It's an infinite radius, or
yeah, it's free bosons from So in this case, what we see is that and this is not directly the meta, but the other approach that I didn't explain, which produces a meta as a result, this tensor network renormalization. But what you can see here is the scaling dimensions that we can obtain in different particle number sectors. And so this would be the identity operator with scaling dimension zero. And then you see a number of other primaries and also the descendants. This should probably be the stress energy tensor, if I'm right. Yeah. And so you see the whole tower. And what you see is scaling dimension zero, which we're used to getting right because it's an exact property of the cosine transformation. But then you can see non-trivial results here. So this should be a 1 with the degeneracy 3, and we get them, 2, and so on. So traditionally, with the meta, we used to get all the way to up here accurately. But nowadays, with these later developments, by the way, this is Marcus, the PhD student at Perimeter, who computed all this. So for instance, I don't know, you can go to scaling dimensions 9, and we still get it right, OK? So in this particular particle number sector. So that's not just very low scaling dimensions, all the way to scaling dimension 9. If I try to get scaling dimension 14, then you see that this is completely off. So that it doesn't work well forever, but we can get a reasonable number of scaling dimensions.
We know that the conformal theory has an infinite number of scaling dimensions. I mean, the mirror ansatz, how many
So in the mirror ansatz, how many scaling dimensions can you get, and what determine the number of scaling dimensions you get?
That's a very good question. So remember that what I said was the local operators are mapped into local operators. So if you remember, the concrete detail was that three-body operators were mapped into three-body. So this three-body operator lives in a Hilbert space of dimension chi times chi times chi, so chi being the bond dimension. So this is a space of chi to the 3 times chi to the 3, so chi to the 6. What I'm saying is the meta can accommodate at most chi to the 6 linearly independent scaling operators. Chi to the 6.
But in practice, how many of them can give you more or less accurate scaling dimension?
In practice, less than that. Some finite number which grows with the bond dimension. So in this case here, I didn't count them, but it looks like there are 20 or 30. I mean, there are plenty of degeneracies here which you don't see. So maybe 40 scaling dimensions. So some number, finite number. Indeed, the conformal towers are infinite, and we only aim at hope to get the most important ones. So you can think of the meta as a truncation in the conformal towers in some sense.
But the URL is larger than chi, I mean, bond dimension.
That's right. Yeah, it's some power of chi. Thanks.
So most of what you talked about was just determining ground states or states of. You mostly talked about just determining ground states. Is there some way to do dynamics? So can you sort of set up the mirror to get a state of some system? And then evolve it with some other Hamiltonian, see how things evolve in some non-trivial fashion.
In real time.
In real time, vertically.
Yeah. So the answer is that generically we won't succeed. And to justify this, it's very easy to justify this answer. Remember that by construction, the amount of entanglement in the resulting state, even before optimization, just the variational class is such that the amount of entanglement only grows logarithmic with the system, with the size of the region. And during dynamics, you expect that the scaling will quickly go to much more than just logarithmic. So this variational class the time evolution will leave this variational class very soon.
So the cases that you presented the data are both one dimension. This case and the two pre-Weiss model are one dimensional cases where CFT gives us, you know, we know everything for 1 plus 1D.
You never mentioned what the dimensional restriction is. DMRG is very good at 1D. Mm-hmm. Is this, you know, can you go beyond 1D with this? Maybe it's obvious. It wasn't clear to me. That was one question. Another question is, you're restricted to finding critical systems. So no matter what the Hamiltonian is, you will only find critical system. Is that correct?
Two questions. I always get confused when there is more than one. So the second question is whether we are restricted to critical systems.
Right.
And the answer is no. So you get critical behavior or scale invariant behavior if you enforce the tensors at different layers of the meta be the same. If you enforce them to be the same, then you have scale invariance. But you don't have to enforce that. And so if you want to study a system away from criticality, you just have to choose different variational parameters to represent different length scales. As you would expect, and in particular, if it's off criticality, this will give you a flow to a product state. So at some point, you don't need to continue this meta. And the first question was about applicability. So in principle, these ideas are based on removing short-range correlations, and they can be applied in arbitrary dimensions. Now there is bad, and this is that when you try in 1 plus 1, everything is nice. When you try in 2 plus 1, we were that was Glenn Evenly tried very hard for. He had partial success, so he had a two-dimensional scheme, but it was not competitive. But luckily, we have this new way of getting the meta now out of a Euclidean path integral, and so now it's the right time to try again and see whether. So conceptually, the framework is there. We don't see any reason why it should not work. We have managed to apply it to three theories, but of course that's not very exciting. So we know it works, but. But we need, now it's a good time to try more seriously for the interacting case in, say, 2 plus 1 dimensions.
So what happens if you have a static situation, not dynamically evolving, but something that's not quite the vacuum, some little bit excited state which would have entanglement entropy scaling slightly different from the log, but not too much? Is there a way to sort of extend this?
So if you just have some finite energy, that's a CFT. If you have low energy excitations, the same tensor network just modifying top tensors will give you those excitations. But those would correspond indeed to the same type of entanglement scaling. If you want to change entanglement scaling, you can either say, no, it's not going to work, or you have to start playing with the bond index. You have to make the bond index larger as you go to larger. This tensor network, so far we assume that all the tensors had the same bond dimension, but there is no reason for this restriction. You could consider that the bond dimension becomes larger and larger higher up, and then that would allow you to represent states with a different type of different scaling of entanglement. Of course, the computational cost is going to grow with that modification.
So in that case, you do the variation by demanding the state be refined.
No, remember that this, in the end, it's a cosherian transformation, that at the very top, you still have some open indices.
Yeah, but if you're dealing with excited states,
yes.
In theory, it's not critical.
Right, so it turns out that excited states, which are low-energy excited states, they share a lot with the ground state, in the sense that you can cosherian the ground state and those states in a similar way. And so the same cosgraining for the ground state will give you a valid cosgraining for those excited states. And then all you need to do is in the top tensors of the meta change those tensors. Since the whole circuit is, you can just diagonalize the effective Hamiltonian that you get at the top, and that will give you ground state and low energy excited states.
And the entanglement entropy is still counted by sort of number of the links that you...
Well, that's an upper bound. You still have to go and compute the reduced density matrix and see whether it conforms to this upper bound, which is the case in practice. But.
One more question.
So is there
any multipartite entanglement in these, or is it possible to put multipartite entanglement in these tensor network states, for example, like a GHZ between three nodes on the lattice?
So you define how do you define multipartite entanglement again?
So if I like have three parties and I remove one, then there's no entanglement between the remaining two.
Right, but here I'm interested in having many parties. So you mean if I take a GHZ, can I encode a GHZ in a mirror? Is that
yes,
an example?
Yes, basically that's the question.
Yeah, so you can do that. Yes, it the fact that this entanglement is shared non-locally. So it's a cat state, a Schrodinger cat state. It implies that by coarse graining, the disentanglers are wasting your time because there is no local entanglement to be removed. So you could just, you can coarse grain it, and it's going to work. It's just that you don't need the disentanglers for anything in that case.
Okay. Thank you, Gifrey, and we will meet again at 10:30 for the next session.